I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, locking down houses of worship and arming the people inside them. In 2018, 11 worshipers were gunned down at a synagogue in Pittsburgh. Last year, a shooting rampage at two mosques in New Zealand killed 51. And just last weekend, two people were shot and killed during Sunday services at a church near Fort Worth, Texas. The attacker was killed by an armed volunteer, a member of the church security team. We'll talk to an interfaith panel about what it takes to protect a place of worship. And we'll hear from you, members of churches, temples, and mosques, about how that changes the experience of worshiping. It's all part of our national call-in special, Sanctuary and Safety. Our conversation starts after a short break. A church shooting near Fort Worth, Texas over the weekend left two dead. 2 years before that, 26 churchgoers were gunned down in Sutherland Springs, Texas. Over the last three decades, there have also been mass shootings at mosques, synagogues, even a Buddhist temple. The idea of a security team standing ready during a service isn't far-fetched. It's reality. Jack Wilson, an armed volunteer, took down the church shooter this past Sunday.
I don't see myself as a hero. I see myself as doing what needed to be done to take out the evil threat.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Are houses of worship with armed congregants the new norm? And if so, how does that change the experience for the people there to worship? That's the question we'll tackle today with an interfaith panel of religious leaders. And it's the question we pose to you, the members of those mosques, churches, and temples. For our national call-in special, Sanctuary and Safety, I'm joined by Imam Shpendim Najaku with the Islamic Association of North Texas, Rabbi Ilana Zeleny of Congregation Beth Torah in Richardson, Texas, and Ted Elmore, Prayer and Special Project Strategist for the Southern Baptists of Texas Convention. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this recent church shooting in White Settlement, which is just west of Fort Worth, left two dead. Witnesses inside the church say the whole confrontation lasted only 6 seconds because a member of the church security team took down the attacker with just one shot. As leaders in the faith space, what's the first thing that goes through your head when you hear something like this? Let's start with you, Ilana.
I think what goes through my head is sorrow and anger that...
Let's get you a little bit closer.
I think what goes through my head, sorrow and anger that this is the state of the world today and that people in their house of worship should be under threat.
Shpendim, what about you? When you hear a story like this and that it happened and that it also happened in the blink of an eye, what's the first thing you think of?
So there's several things that run through my head. The first is like, oh my God, again. And the second is, I pray that this doesn't happen again, but then there's always that fear that says, oh my God, is it something that's going to perhaps even strike closer to home or hit home itself, which is that fear that I think is always recurring.
Ted, what about you?
Well, I have a deep sadness. I mean, when I heard this, I teared up. Once again, evil has come into places of worship, and out of that, the questions of why, the questions of how we prepare, and more importantly, how do we prevent in the future are all things that run through my mind.
Do people in your congregation seek you out or, you know, people that you counsel when something like this happens? What questions do you get?
Well, the people in the congregations typically are pretty numb when this happens, the ones I've dealt with. And the questions comes later. There's always the why question. It's just part of our nature. Why would this evil happen? Why would it happen to us now? But I find they recover fairly quickly from that. And they put their trust in God and they move forward. The thing that helps them to move forward is a faith community that gathers around them and doesn't try to answer a lot of questions, but just loves them and is there for them.
And I wonder, obviously, any congregation that goes through this actual trauma that is there that day or it's a member of their church that was involved, that's got to be really difficult. What about people that are just a part of any mosque, any temple, any synagogue, any church? What questions do you hear from people who can relate but were not related to this specific tragedy?
Well, more often in my congregation, they want to know what we're doing to increase security at our particular community. They want to know that we're taking sensible precautions to try to prevent a tragedy at our synagogue.
And when did you really start thinking about building security? Obviously, it's something that's top of mind now, and we've heard a lot about it. Was there a kind of a turning point when something happened, when you or Shvenbin, when you thought, this is the time that we have to make a plan?
So I think for us, it began when I kind of moved down into Dallas and was greeted by armed protesters. That for the first time in my life, I saw the freedom of expression being people holding rifles and assault things and all of that sort of stuff, claiming to express their freedom to demonstrate. And the congregation as a whole was just terrorized by it. We felt like, oh my God, what happens if these folks decide to go renegade and start shooting at us and all? So that's when we really took seriously the aspect of safety and security for the congregation.
And I was going to ask you a little bit more about that. One thing that we all remember hearing about is the attack at the two mosques in New Zealand last year that at final count, I think 51 worshipers were killed. We want to hear now a clip from the CARE National Executive Director, Nihad Awad, speaking at a press conference after that mass shooting. And CARE, of course, is the Council on American Islamic Relations.
They have very legitimate fears. And they are being told to be afraid by white supremacists and political leaders who believe in white supremacy. And we tell our community, do not be afraid and do not abandon your mosques. Not today, not ever. They want you to be afraid. You should not be afraid. You should be protected.
So obviously a shooting of that scale is going to get a lot of international attention. But as you just alluded to, there's what's known as anti-mosque activity happening all the time. According to the ACLU, there have been 28 documented anti-mosque incidents just in Texas since 2006. Those can range from things like protesters threatening phone calls, arson, stabbings. How do you protect against all that?
So some of the steps that we've taken along with many other mosques throughout the area and region is to actually work hand in hand with our local police department. And they've been a fantastic support, as well as following their leadership. Among other things, is we've actually hired armed security to be present on location. And in addition to that, we've even taken a further step of having congregation that's trained for security and safety measures, armed as well as unarmed.
And is that something, Ted, that you have seen a lot of organization with as well?
It absolutely is. And I would want to say, too, as a Southern Baptist, that one of the great tenets of our belief is freedom of religion. So when we see mosques attacked, there's no joy in that. And when one is attacked, all of us are attacked. And yes, I believe that we should take steps to prepare. In fact, we have a group that goes to our churches at the church's request and teaches them church security and how to prepare, recommending that you contract with the local police. You need people like the gentleman in White Settlement who had training, who could teach local church security. And having been in law enforcement, as you see, a lot happens in 6 seconds.
Ilana, there's been a rash of anti-Semitic violence in the last few years. I think most of us remember the synagogue shootings in Pittsburgh, but there's also been the recent stabbings at the Hanukkah party in New York, attacks at kosher grocery stores there, not even just specific houses of worship, but places of fellowship and celebration and places important to Jewish culture. How do you, you know, speak to your congregation about that when it's something that you see in the news day in, day out?
Well, I think it's important to remain publicly Jewish and proudly Jewish, because when we stop doing that, the anti-Semites and terrorists just win sooner. So I encourage them to continue to attend Jewish events and synagogue, and I encourage them to express their Judaism in the world outside.
So each state has its own laws when it comes to carrying firearms into houses of worship. The laws here in Texas have recently changed, so we're going to hear now from Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick.
In December of 2017, I'd asked the Attorney General for an opinion of could you carry a weapon if you had a concealed permit in a church. We believed you could, but we wanted the Attorney General's opinion, and we turned that into a law Senate Bill 635 that was signed into law by Governor Abbott this past session, that made sure, unless a church posted a sign, that you could carry a concealed carry.
I want to let all of you speak to this, but first, Ted, how do you feel about the idea that any concealed carry permit holder can bring a gun inside a church unless the sign tells them not to?
I'm a bit conflicted. Having been in law enforcement, my training taught me not only how to shoot, but when to shoot, and more importantly, when not to shoot. And that's always a concern. The other side of the equation is that those who have their license to carry are trained to some degree, and they do have a double background check, both state and federal. So these are basically good people. And if you notice the video in White Settlement that was all over the internet, none of those people that pulled their weapon fired. They rushed toward the danger to protect their families and to protect their children. So I am more comfortable with measures that would allow us to protect our families than I am laws that would forbid. Bad guys don't obey the law. That's the problem. They do what they choose to do, and you never know who they are or what they're thinking.
Spendim, what do you think? Guns in houses of worship?
I mean, ideally, it'd be best to not have any of that. But I do second what Ted just mentioned, that unfortunately, those who are ill and intend on harming others, they don't necessarily abide by what there are of laws. And so it's almost as though to protect oneself and to protect the congregation that we have those postings out there that nobody should be coming in. But with that, there's still this need to ensure that if and when, God forbid, somebody does take that measure, that there will be something of a defensive line that's there to protect.
Ilana, your thoughts? Were you surprised when the law changed to allow this?
No, we were paying close attention because it was a matter of interest to the leadership in our synagogue. And I think whether you decide we don't want concealed weapons and you put up a sign, or whether you decide you do, the reality is people will be carrying concealed weapons in our congregations. The odds of someone doing that in Texas are pretty high. So since that's the reality on the ground, then I think communities need to deal with training individuals that want to carry concealed weapons. Because while they may know how to fire their gun safely at a target at a range, they need more information about how to fire a gun safely in a panicked crowd, or like Ted said, wait to fire.
I'm curious whether governing bodies like the Southern Baptist Convention have issued any best practices on congregation safety, building security. Do you get any guidance there?
Some. Baptist churches are autonomous, and conventions in our denomination have no authority over the church. Mm-hmm. So what we do is provide resources, and we try to point them in the best direction. And at least for the Southern Baptists of Texas Convention, the group that we work with and recommend to the churches is out of Prestonwood Baptist Church in Dallas. They are a state-licensed security training group. And so we feel like that's the best way to do this. Here's the offer. Here's who can come. And we let the churches decide whether they choose to use them or not. What I have done is written an instant preparation and recovery manual that helps us to pray beforehand, but God forbid something should happen. Here are some best practices and some steps you need to take to be prepared before the shooting occurs.
And we're nearly at the break now, but have either of you had to seek guidance, or is it kind of a play-by-ear situation?
Well, we have an organization called the Federation of Greater Dallas, and they are an umbrella organization for the Jewish community. And in the last few years, they've hired a security expert to coordinate all of our efforts and have also provided some funding for the Jewish organizations in the Dallas area to put in infrastructure that provides better security.
You're listening to our Think Call-In special, Sanctuary and Safety. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Think, I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Today's conversation is called Sanctuary and Safety and examines protection in places of worship in the wake of several fatal shootings at synagogues, mosques, and churches. We're speaking today with an interfaith panel of faith leaders who will rejoin in just a few minutes. First, KERA's Hadi Mawagdi, who reports for multi-station Guns in America Project, explains what's led sanctuaries to harden their defenses in hopes of saving lives.
Jimmy Meeks is a retired police officer and pastor. He spent 35 years serving communities in Texas and Oklahoma. But these days, he travels around the country conducting sheepdog seminars, calling on churchgoers to prepare for violent attacks. And he says this is his number one tip.
Wake up. If you're not awake, it doesn't matter what we tell you to do. If you sleep through the news and everything that's going on, you're not going to concern yourself with safety.
Meek's 8-hour, $75 seminars can be alarming. He says they need to be that way because most folks aren't aware of how many people are dying in places of worship.
Over 900 people have died a violent death on church and faith-based property since 1999. That number is just as high, if not higher, than school shootings. That number is higher than the number of police officers killed every year.
Those statistics come from the Deadly Force Incident Study. It's a database operated by the Faith-Based Security Network. That's a patchwork of security and law enforcement professionals hoping to make faith-based organizations safe. David Riggle has the same goal.
We put them through a basic combat pistol class, an intermediate pistol class, and an advanced pistol class. We also do.
Riggle's been a police officer in Texas for 16 years. He's also the founder of a company that trains volunteers to be part of church security teams. His workshops across Texas last 4 weekends and include active threat training, hand-to-hand combat skills, and life-saving medical coaching.
We actually do in-service training every 6 months after the academy, make them stay sharp on their skills, or we'll pull their license and not let them work anymore. So they have to continue that education.
Riggle points out shootings like the one at West Freeway Church of Christ usually end within moments, long before police can arrive. His training helps volunteers fill in the gap. The White Settlement Church used a similar training program.
And the type of people that have been put in front of me love it. I mean, they've got a heart for protection. They got a heart for God. They want to do what's right. They know that they could die doing this, and it doesn't bother them.
Brad Orsini says it's crucial to have trained security like Jack Wilson, the church member who shot the gunman in White Settlement. Orsini has firsthand experience. He's the director of security for the Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh, and he responded last fall when the shooting began at the Tree of Life Synagogue.
We don't want the first time that people have to react is in a real-time situation, right? We want to be able to develop good protocols and procedures where it's instinctual. We build muscle memory inside the brains of all our congregants, so if something bad happens, they know how to react.
That muscle memory saves lives. 11 people died last October 25th in Pittsburgh, but survivors said training on things like escape routes saved countless lives. Still, Orsini has concerns.
Guns are not always the answer. It's a layered security approach that we must push into every one of our houses of worship. They all need to collectively be working.
His top priorities? Securing entry points, teaching escape protocols, and having an armed presence so a sanctuary can really be a sanctuary.
That was KERA's Hadi Mawagdi reporting for the Guns in America Project. After listening to that, I'd be interested to hear from each of you on any security training you or your members of your congregations have completed. Let's start with Rabbi Elena Zeleny.
So we have hired a private security firm. And they helped us build a team of volunteers who help provide security. I think the speaker was correct in saying it starts before people even get into your sanctuary. So there is a professional armed guard outside of our sanctuary. Then there's a volunteer in the lobby. And part of what they're looking for is strange behavior. And we have a walkie-talkie from the guard on the outside to the greeter on the inside so that we can communicate information, hey, lock down the sanctuary, putting multiple layers of greeters who can close off doors is a really good idea to prevent someone from even getting there. But I would say security starts really in the outside world past your parking lot. Mm-hmm. Security starts with having a good relationship with your city hall, with your police force, with the civic organizations, with your neighbors. So being a participant in the community and having people in the community know who you are provides a level of security.
So Ted Elmore, I heard a nod of agreement there. You're with the Prayer and Special Project Strategist for Southern Baptists of Texas Convention.
Well, I do agree with Alana. It begins prior to the parking lot and in the parking lot, and all that she said, I agree. One of my really good friends that has been with DPS for a number of years, that was the security leader in one church I was in, told me, he said, the second worst day of your life is when you pull your gun. The worst day is when you have to fire it. It doesn't matter if you're right or wrong. And I agree with protecting the people, and sometimes that choice has to be made, but it's not a good choice. In the training, I personally, and of course I don't deal with every special project, I'm basically our instant response leader, but I shy away from fear-based training. We need to know facts. We need to train a group of people in the church, but we have to always realize that just as the bad guy will do something that will frighten and hurt our children, we don't want to be part of that. We want our children to feel safe. We want our congregants to feel safe. And so starting from parking lot to pew and having a well-trained security force, some obviously armed, some perhaps armed, but undercover throughout the congregation, I believe is one of the best ways to go. The last gentleman was correct. Guns are not always the answer. There's more to it than just shooting.
And let's talk now to Imam Shendim Najaku. Any security, I mean, you touched on this a bit earlier, but any security training that your mosque has taken on, what's kind of your approach to keeping things safe?
So we have actually engaged with the local police department, and we've also contracted with private individuals and organizations focusing on the holistic approach. And a major part of it was the deterrence. And so with the deterrence, many things such as making sure that there's ample lighting, make sure that there's cameras in place, signage that's out there, and among other things to hopefully deter whoever may be, thinking anything evil in that sense. But then the other aspect of it is if and when, God forbid, it ever gets to that point, to ensure that there also be people in place to do what's needed to, if even need be, sacrifice their own lives for the safety and well-being of others. I took a major step myself after having gone through some of these classes and programs to get my own license to carry.
Let's take a call now from Michael in Richardson, Texas. Michael, go ahead.
Hi. My question for the panel is really, do more guns make us safer in church? Because it seems like the answer that I'm hearing is that the more concealed weapons we have in church, the more safer we are. And the other question I had was the accidental shootings, is at an all-time high for this country. If more guns made us safer, we'd be the safest country on earth, because more guns and more concealed guns actually lead to more chances for accidental shootings and for domestic shootings and for people who are not homogeneous bad guys and good guys, but people who would just get upset and use a gun.
What do you think? Is not to pardon the pun, but is that having the gun concealed, the silver bullet, is it going to fix everything, or does it all depend on context?
I think one of the statements that I had heard which made sense to me was it's better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it. So it's not the solution as much as it's part of the whole deterrence. But if, God forbid, it ever gets to that point, it is better to have it if you need it than to be caught off guard and not have anything.
Here's an email question now. The question posed is, rather than go on the defensive against guns and protect the congregations after the fact, why don't faith leaders take up the mantle for stricter gun control? Ilana or Ted, do either of you want to comment on that?
Well, there are multiple opinions in Jewish sources about gun control. The one where people start is that if you have a roof, you're commanded to build a fence around the roof. And so that means if there's a dangerous situation that you can prevent, God obligates us to prevent it. Now, does that mean that we should go towards stricter gun control? Perhaps. Does that mean that we should ensure there are better mental health services? Perhaps. Does that mean that we should ensure that impoverished people in this nation are taken care of? Perhaps. I don't know as gun control is the only answer to preventing gun violence.
Ted, do you have thoughts on this? It's obviously a political issue that has seeped its way deep into the faith community.
Deep into the faith community, and it's across the board, even in conservative Southern Baptist life. But I do not favor, I don't buy the argument that greater gun control stops these things. These incidents do not happen with normal people. They happen with people that's 100% mentally ill at some point or another. And that's the FBI statistics. So it doesn't matter if the good guy doesn't have a gun, the bad guy does. Or he has a bomb, or he has some other way to do harm, or she, and they can do harm. So I think the relevant issue is the training of your church security force. I think that the common citizen probably has more common sense on their worst day than most politicians do on their best day.
So I was wondering about religious text. Obviously, firearms are not expressly mentioned in the Bible or the Quran or the Torah because there were no firearms when those texts came to be. Is there any guidance to be found there, though? Any direction when it comes to protecting people in a place of worship?
I think so. I do. Jesus talked about the children, and he talked about them in the context of their trusting and believing in him. And he said, for anyone who would harm one of these children, it's better that a millstone be hanged around his neck and him cast into the depth of the sea. So I see all through the New Testament, I see in Psalm 78 in the Old Testament, not just transmission of the faith to the children, but also protecting them and guiding them along the way and guaranteeing them as much security as we are possibly able to do. So I deduct from that we should protect our children.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. One thing I was just wondering if any of you had any thoughts on is, you know, whether it's armed congregants or visible security or really high-tech camera systems, are any of you simply unsettled by this so-called hardening of houses of worship? Shbenvim, do you have a thought on that?
I don't know that my thought is really... I think it's almost biology that unfortunately as we become more exposed to something that it's almost natural to become a bit desensitized. So when we first had to go ahead and have a police officer on presence, it was very uncomfortable. It's, you know, it seemed out of place. But with more and more of these horrific events happening at houses of worship and the need to make ourselves feel that we are safe, you kind of become used to it. So it's almost as though when you don't see them, you're like, hey, you know, something is missing.
What about you, Ilana? Do you ever feel just vaguely unsettled by the conversation of guns in the synagogue?
I often feel extremely unsettled by the fact that this has become a commonplace conversation. But I think it's not unique to houses of worship. My children in their school practice lockdown drills, and they know exactly why they're doing it. It's been a change in society. So what do I do with those unsettled feelings for myself and my congregation? A couple of things. One is to point out that we take sensible precautions, right? If you were afraid of getting in a car accident, you'd put on a seatbelt. You wouldn't stop driving. And the same is true of going to your house of worship. And the other thing is to say, in the end, it's all in God's hands, and to have faith, and also to examine what we've gained, because since the country has become aware of these needs, I've also seen tremendous collaboration, both in the synagogue. Folks that normally would be on the periphery of worship are attending because they want to be part of the security team. And then in the relationships with our neighbors, we're all struggling with the same thing. And as we reach out to each other, we become friends in ways that we might not have if we weren't under fire.
I have another email question that any of you can address, but the question is posed, I would like to know, beyond the practical thoughts of, quote, we need to talk about security, I'd like to know, what have you heard from congregants? Have you gotten calls or emails from concerned members? What are they saying? Do you have to calm them down, or are they saying they don't want any changes in security, that they want to feel at peace? And that's a lot of questions inside of a question, but I guess the point is, what do people who sit in services say about these changes becoming more and more commonplace?
Well, I'll give you a classic example at Sutherland Springs. This was a church that on a good Sunday worship, they might have 60 in attendance. And when 26 people were killed, they came together, they wept, they buried their dead. And Southern Baptist, through the North American Mission Board, rebuilt their church facility for them and rebuilt it much safer than the older facility was. But that congregation now on any given Sunday is three times the size that it once was. And Courtney, what we gather from that is, I think this is true for all people of faith. Our faith is in God. It's not in the guns. It's in God. And we will not let evil win. We will not.
Shpendi, I wonder what you're hearing from people at the mosque. Are you having to offer a lot of calmness and tranquility? Do you have to soothe congregants, or are people just accepting that this is new, and new might not be normal at the beginning, but it might be soon?
So every time one of these horrific acts takes place, it reignites that fear within the congregation. Mm-hmm. There's the fear of parents with regards to their children. There's the fear of, you know, the younger folk who are worried, you know, is this going to be something that could happen where they're at? Everybody in the end wants to feel safe. They want to be able to come to worship and not have to worry about, is something possibly going to happen? They want to be reassured and reaffirmed and confirmed that we've taken the necessary measures.
I'm Courtney Collins in today for Chris Boyd. We're calling this conversation Sanctuary and Safety and talking a little bit about security inside houses of worship. We're joined by a panel of religious leaders, including Imam Shpendi Mnajaku with the Islamic Association of North Texas, Rabbi Ilana Zaloni of Congregation Beth Torah in Richardson, Texas, and Ted Elmore, prayer and special project strategist for the Southern Baptists of Texas Convention. Thank you all for being here today. I wonder how you think security changes the worshiping experience for members of your congregation. Is it the same as it was 20 or 30 years ago? We were chatting during the break. Ted said that the church he grew up in, nobody locked the door. You could walk in and out as you pleased. Is it different now to worship in, you know, a place with maybe an armed guard out front?
Oh, I think it's different. But in our context, I do not believe the people are paying that much attention to the security. In fact, most of the security is actually not armed in the sense that people see them carrying a gun. They're not uniformed. And so people go in with a focus on God, a focus to worship, and they're aware that there's security. They're comforted by it, but it's not that much of a distraction.
Do you all think that the same holds true for y'all's congregations? Ilana, what about you?
Yes, I think it's led to conversations at board meetings, more than it's changed worship in the sanctuary. I'd say the biggest change it's made is that every 6 weeks or so, I remind people where all the exits are in the building, as well as the defibrillator and the fire extinguishers.
Hmm. Same question to you, Shpendi. What do you think?
So I think that with regards to certain demographics of our congregation, that this is the norm for them. The younger folk, who this is all they've seen within this past decade, for example. So they don't know anything else to compare it to. But others, as far as the larger congregation, the communication is for the most part that they feel satisfied and comfortable with steps that have, you know, been taken. The worship doesn't seem to have any detractions because of the security measures or anything of that sort. So it seems as though we've reached a, you know, comfortable medium there.
On the same note, we got another email question, and it's worded, how do you see our watchfulness and fear changing how young people in your congregations are approaching their religion? Are they picking up on different texts to guide them? Are they more cynical? What do you think? Let's start with you, Rabbi.
I think that they're stressed out more. I see levels of depression and anxiety, particularly in children and teenagers, that are just overwhelming and sad that this is the world they live in, where they worry about going to school and the grocery store and the movies and their synagogue. So we have increased efforts in our pastoral care to try to address people and also use worship and sermon time to give uplifting and hopeful messages.
I've been impressed the more young people I've interviewed at how curious the minds of teenagers and 20-somethings especially are. They want to learn. They want knowledge. Do you find that that helps with regards to when we talk about shootings and houses of worship? Are young people just, do they have more of a desire to understand what's happening and learn about how to move through it? What do you think, Shvenbeam?
So I think there's many things, Courtney. I mean, one of them is to understand why, because that essential need to understand is always there, that human ability to try to make sense of the world around them. Why is this happening? And in understanding or seeking to understand, they want to be proactive in trying to prevent these things from happening. So if it's mental illness, finding that many of them are thinking about getting into these fields, social work and medicine and so on. If it's an issue of poverty and things of that sort, to try to work towards alleviating what there is of poverty. But there's also that aspect of what the rabbi mentioned, that there is an increase of anxiety that's there, and there's even an aspect of fear where sometimes, especially when something like this is fresh, that it brings it up once again to the surface.
Ted, we know that church membership has kind of steadily declined over the last two decades. Do you think questions of safety and security influence membership?
Courtney, I really do not. I believe that other things that influence membership do not include safety and security. That might be true for some, but certainly not the majority. And I would like to talk about this thing with the kids for just a moment.
Sure.
Being a grandfather, and I've long since passed the time when I can speak to a youth camp, but I just don't look good in skinny jeans. That has gone by me a long time ago. But what we do in our prayer initiatives and things of this nature is help young people to trust in God, to understand that they can pray in their own way and they can know Him through Jesus Christ and trust Him. And I'm finding kids that in their own way are looking for people in the schools that might be dangerous, when in another generation they did not. But I think kids are taking more and more personal responsibility, and I'm encouraged about the next generation. Church attendance is waning, but that doesn't necessarily mean that their faith in God is gone.
Let's take another call. We'll go now to Liz in Duncanville, Texas. Liz, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just wondering, and this may be a simpleton's view of looking at this, but what about just simple metal detectors, just like you go through at an airport? It's easier to subdue one person with nothing instead of having to police and camera and do all of these other, or have all these other precautions, when everyone could just go through a metal detector and feel a lot safer, maybe for a lot less. But again, I'm looking at just subduing one person with nothing instead of someone with a knife or a gun.
Metal detectors, is anybody using them?
I think they may be coming. I think Liz has a very good question. One of the issues that I see with metal detectors is the cost, especially for small congregations. We must keep in mind that most of these are what would be considered soft targets. In other words, an assailant may think that there's not protection there. And so larger churches with more resources may go to the metal detectors. I think she's very accurate in that. But I think for the smaller church, it's a cost factor.
Do either of you have a follow-up to that?
There's an aesthetic factor, too, that when we get to the point where our houses of worship look like security compounds, it can be disturbing for our worshipers. That being said, I think security requires a number of solutions.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, it has been brought up in discussions that we've had for our security and safety. And for the time being, it hasn't been included as an option, but God only knows what the future holds.
I wonder, have shootings at houses of worship changed the way that you share the Word of God? And has it influenced the way you prepare messages for services?
So I know that for us, it's always one of trying to connect people with God and help us to understand that the world with all of its chaos, that for us at least, that it appears that way, that our belief that God is supreme, that he is all merciful, that he does protect, that the stronger our faith and our relationship with God is, that the better off we'll feel regardless of what's happening in our lives, because it's faith that helps us to overcome and surmount the challenges in life, whether it be health, whether it be relationships, financial, or even the craziness of crime and things of that sort that can afflict us.
Ilana, what do you think? Are you guided a bit by what's happening in the world?
Yes, I think it's important for the leadership of houses of worship to point out all the sensible precautions we're taking. And then I think it's also the responsibility for the spiritual leaders in houses of worship to remind their people that they need to remain faithful. There was an episode of Mad Men, and this one was set during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and a lapsed Catholic goes to talk to her priest, and she says, "Don't you just feel panicked about all of this?" And he says, "Well, no, because we're all going to die eventually, and I have faith in God," essentially. So finding ways to talk about faithfulness and hopefulness. And while I would not wish this violence to be the catalyst that has brought the Richardson community together, to point out the ways in which it has. You know, I got contacted after the stabbing at the Hanukkah party by a pastor who said, "We want to organize a vigil for Sunday night for your community to be supportive of you." And I said, "Thank you very much. And let's remember everyone who feels vulnerable and fragile right now and invite them too." So I hate that violence is the catalyst, but it's important to point out to our worshipers that it is bringing people together more than it's tearing them apart.
And that's an interesting question. And to follow up on that, I mean, how much connection when there's attack at a house of worship? I mean, you're leaders of different faiths, but does it bring unity that surprises you between churches, mosques, synagogues, but also within, you know, people that wouldn't have connected within your congregations?
Well, I think there's a fellowship of recognition that we are all human and we, as such, created in the image of God. And yet in our distinctive faith approaches, we understand those differences, but at the same time, we are combating a universal evil in a broken world. And so in that aspect, we move forward together. But I'd like to go back to your other question, how does that affect your preaching and teaching? And Jesus said, "In the world you'll have trouble, but be of good cheer, I've overcome the world." So I'm more reminded to be faithful, to give hope and hope through him as we go forward. And I think I see our people coming together. I really do. It's small. It's not on the macro stage. It's on the micro stage, but it is happening.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. So why is it so important for people to come together in worship in a church, a synagogue, a mosque? What's different about that compared to praying at home or studying a religious text on your own?
So in coming together, there's that aspect of community, and faith thrives in community. So folks can certainly pray on their own, and they do, and they have many opportunities to do so. But for us as Muslims, especially where the congregational prayers 5 times a day, 7 days a week are the norm, it's to reinforce that aspect of community belonging to a larger body of faithful. And in doing so, to see that larger family and the larger family being there for each other. And in being there for each other, part of it even addresses this aspect of when people do have concerns and fears, to be able to help them settle what they may have of concerns and fears, to be there for them in whatever's happening within their lives. And so in having that reinforced on a regular basis, daily, it's priceless.
Ilana, same question to you. Why come together? What does fellowship do for your faith that you can't get on your own at home?
So in Judaism, there are particular prayers we can't say without a quorum, without a minyan. And again, we're encouraged to pray in community because it's in isolation that we succumb to darkness, that we that our fears loom large, that we feel lonely and powerless. But in community, we can look after one another and we can remind ourselves how empowered we are to address the challenges of the world together.
And Ted, same to you.
Oh, good. Thank you. In Christianity, we believe that Jesus came to die on the cross for our sins, was buried and raised from the dead. And the prophet Isaiah taught us that he is our intercessor. So when we come together to pray, we pray in Jesus' name. And the value is that when the people of God who trust in him come together, he said, where two or three are gathered in my name, I am in the midst. Mm-hmm. And so we believe that, and we believe that God is among us, and it is corporate, and it is important. And I agree with Alana, praying in isolation can sometimes be destructive. We really need each other.
So religion has a lot of customs, traditions. Many faiths have kind of relaxed certain aspects of worship. For example, I'm thinking of a contemporary service at a church where you can wear jeans, where you've got some Beatles covers being played by the praise band. That's been widely accepted. Will a visible security presence at a house of worship eventually just become kind of part of the furniture of going to services?
I think it already has.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, as long as we're in this era, yes, it will happen.
And we only have a couple minutes left, but one question I'd like all of you to address is, we don't always talk about, when we address security in a church building, if it actually helps congregations feel safer. Does it work, what we're doing, all of these efforts to make the building secure, to make the congregation safe? Do they feel that? And Ted, you can start.
Yes, they do. And the reason they do is because when married couples with children begin attending church, they want to know how safe their children are in the nursery, in the children's area, and that determines their choice of congregation very often. So I believe that is critical to reaching people in today's world.
And you've heard the same from people who attend, that they want it and they need it?
They want to be safe.
Same question to you, Sven. I mean, what do you think? Do you think that the measures and the painstaking planning that your mosque takes, is it felt and appreciated by the people worshiping there?
So, Courtney, I would agree with what Ted said, that yes, what they see of updates and advancements and communication for their safety and well-being is certainly appreciated. It does help to comfort them, and it makes all the difference.
Ilana, real quick.
I would agree with Ted and Shpendim, and I would also say there's been this interesting marriage between our greeting committee, our welcoming committee, and our security committee, because when you reach out and you greet people, you also increase security because you know who's there and that they look like they belong.
Thank you to Imam Shpendim Nezaku, Rabbi Ilana Zeleny, and Ted Elmore. Thank you all for your time today. What a great conversation.
Thank you, Courtney.
You've been listening to a special episode of Think called Sanctuary and Safety. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great day.